The Metal Mentality Podcast is brought to you in partnership with AM300 and the Phoenix Project. For more information on both, check out am300.com/metal.
It's time for you to be the you that you know you can be and define your metal. My name is Preston Yule, and I'm the host of the Metal Mentality Podcast. I'm a husband, a father, and American soldier. What is metal? It's your strength of character that you rely on to endure hardship. It's your grit. Together, we'll learn from some dedicated, passionate, metal-minded individuals who define themselves by their grit and their graduation from suffering. Be metal. Stay metal.
I want to welcome everybody back to part two of our interview with Jesse Stewart. Jesse, thank you for taking the time to do this and give us more of your time and open up and be vulnerable and share more of your story.
No problem, my friend. No problem.
We were about to talk about the stigma around mental health, particularly in men and in the military. Why do you think there is a stigma around asking for help, especially for men? Let's talk about in the civilian world, then we'll get into the military world. Why are men reluctant to talk about mental health and ask for help? What's your opinion on that?
So starting on the civilian side, obviously it comes around a lot of, you know, society, culture, all that stuff. I can only speak from my standpoint, and, it comes back to, we don't want to be perceived as weak. And, I still have a tough time outwardly showing it, but I've definitely transitioned my thought process on it. And a lot of it was thankful to Dr. Brené Brown, who's someone that just really spoke to me. She was actually the one that inspired my TED Talk that I did. And, it just comes from this culture that we can't be weak and we can't be perceived as weak. And I think for some of us, at least in my case, that was obviously exacerbated by, my service in the military, especially the community that I came from.
I think it goes back to, I think about the generation of like the 50s and 60s where like.
Yeah, but I'm struggling to answer this question because, I know why, and it's pathetic.
I'm trying to justify it. Where did this come from? Like, why are men not allowed to talk about it?
Yeah, it's, a lot of it comes down to just character defects, right? That we generally, at least I have, I don't want to, throw any guy under the bus there, but I'll throw myself under, just character defects of it's weak to ask for help. And it's weak to admit something might be wrong. And those are the things that, translate. I guess it's probably the same, the military, as it is a civilian life. It's when I think about it now, it's pretty pathetic. But it's the way it is. So we can either sit here and get all wrapped around the axle about it's pathetic and how guys suck and how we're emotionally stunted in our growth, or we can say, okay, let's attempt to meet people where they are. And then try and walk the problem back. And that's what I try to do, with people that I encounter, people that encounter me and kind of struggle with trying to figure me out, which I'm actually a pretty simple person. I think it's, that's what I think the key is. And I think that's why Dr. Brené Brown is really hit home with a lot of people is, she brings in like, Teddy Roosevelt sayings of, let's just be the man in the arena and let's keep getting back up and all that stuff. And so she's done a really good job of it. And I'd like to think that I've kind of modeled off of her example, because she was someone I started reading about when I first came into this journey. But I think it's the same generally from the military and civilian side. And the military has changed a lot since 2007, where a majority of this stuff happened to me. So it's gotten better in some parts, and certain parts it hasn't, because if you admit certain things, you're going to lose security clearances. If you get help for certain things, you're going to lose security clearances. And so and that's why I've gotten so passionate. We've talked a little bit about this platform that I'm assisting right now, playtag.tv. It's something that that is it's a start. And it's meeting people where they are and then trying to bring them in. If your thing is sitting in a circle with a bunch of other men and opening up, great. For me, that's not necessarily what it is. It's more of an intimate thing, you know, where I open up, because I mean, my strength, I'm proud of that now. So I'm careful, you know, how I let it down, but I think it's just important to meet people where they are.
That actually answers my next question. My next question was, where do we start to fix this problem? And I think that's what it is. If you see someone that's in position where they're struggling, meet them where they are and find a way to relate to them through your own experience.
Yeah. There's a quote. I don't know who I stole it from, but you know, if you make the struggle to take that first step towards the universe will take two to meet you where you are. And you know, that has been, you know, huge in my life. And I think that, you know, generally speaking, you know, if you make that effort, you know, to take two steps to meet someone where they are, they're going to take that one step, you know, to attempt to meet you where they are. And I think that is honestly the key is, you know, doing that. But, you know, some people will sit there and say, well, that's, you know, they're not falling in line with how they should act, or they're not falling in line with the mainstream. Oh, everyone needs to be vulnerable. Well, if you go with that attitude, then that's just going to close them up even more. And so you got to be careful about it, I think.
Yeah.
It's not a cookie cutter solution.
No, and there's not just one.
Somebody to attempt to meet where they are is going to be a lot more willing to open up to you than, you know, you telling them where to meet you.
Yeah, that's a great point. What I found when if I'm attempting to connect with someone, I can't come at them and say, you need to do this, 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 and this. I'll say like, man, I remember a time I had this going on and I felt this way. I understand how you feel. I think begins with having empathy for that person, willingness to show your vulnerability to them, that you're a safe person. But I think it just starts with talking.
Yes. And there's a big difference, you know, between empathy and sympathy.
Absolutely.
And Dr. Brené Brown, I just read her most recent book. I believe it's called Rising Strong. And she has a whole chapter devoted to that, of how we kind of screw things up sometimes because we come to people with sympathy when really all they need is empathy. Because you come to someone with sympathy, all you're doing is reinforcing the crappy situation that they're in. Come there with empathy, well, then we're like, we're going through the suck together, right? We're embracing the struggle together. You know, but I think everybody just needs to find their balance, right? Because if somebody tries to, you know, take down all those walls immediately, well, then they're going to be exposed and they're going to end up feeling, you know, like they're being attacked or something. And so it's a happy balance of where you find that. And I've had to do that with my daughters because, you know, 3 years ago, their father was a walled up, you know, emotionally closed up individual that had very little capability of, you know, relating to anybody at all. And now it's, you know, come into what I like to think is, you know, a happy balance. And all I know is that I just don't want to pass on those things to them that, you know, the struggles that I had.
So, but as you're talking about this, it's the same in the military as in the civilian world. I think that's true to an extent, but what the catalyst that started this me doing this podcast was actually a soldier coming to me and telling me that they had attempted to take their own life 3 times in the past 6 months. And they just said it so nonchalantly. And I was like, oh man, I am not prepared for this. And he had the guts to come forward and say, hey, I need help. And he got the help that he needed. And it was a long journey. And that just kind of evolved into me wanting to help more people than this podcast is than where I'm at now with it. And he did he got put on a mental health profile and was prevented from doing a lot of training and it did have consequences. What can we do as veterans and members of the military to encourage people to come forward, even knowing those possible consequences are there?
Yeah, that's a tough issue because, you know, if they're working for a defense contractor and they've got to maintain their security clearance, you know, that's something that they got to think about. And, you know, the ultimate solution is, you know, reducing the stigma on it. But where does that, you know, that's just is such a difficult conversation. I was just having that with the board members at the TAG, because you know that play tag thing is something I would like to try and give to some of my buddies that are working in the defense industry, so they have some sort of outlet. Because for me, had I had something like that back in 2008, who knows, that may have kept me from, you know, getting to the point that I got to. But you know, how we can do it now is, you know, you can talk your story all day long till you're blue in the face. The bottom line is, people are not going to care until they see it in action. And so the best thing that you can do is to live it. And that's the only thing you can do, because people, I mean, think about the leader that just talks, do as I say, not as what I do. You know,
right.
You instantly just rebel against what they're saying. And so the best thing that we can do is, yeah, we advocate for what we're doing on platforms like this. We write about it, you know, we post about it, whatever. But ultimately, if there's no action, then it's dead. It's like the, you know, the Bible verse, faith without works is dead. You know, it's the same thing here. And, you know, that's the biggest thing that we can do. And it doesn't have to be on a TEDx stage or something like that. It can be as simple as literally just go asking a guy that looks like he's sucking, what is going on, man? Let's go grab a cup of coffee. Let's go grab a workout. Let's go to the Brazilian jiu-jitsu gym and get after it.
Is that you got to get it out of me? Like, why I insulted you? Is that what it is?
Yeah. So those are tangible things that we can do. You know, if one person helps two people and those two people help two people, all of a sudden those numbers exponentiate very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that. Yeah. What was the name of that movie? Pay It Forward or something like that.
Yeah. But this got Kevin Spacey in it. So let's, I don't talk about that. But no, the concept, the producers and directors and writers of that movie, it was a great flick. And yeah. I remember seeing it, and it definitely spoke to me quite a bit. And, you know, and I was on the other podcast that I had done, he had asked about tangible ways to, you know, to do that. And I said, you know, go to a Starbucks and buy a gift card and give it to the barista on your way out and leave. Don't sit there and record it and post it on Instagram, what you just did. You know, don't take a picture of the stuff. Just, you know, do something like that and then you leave. And then, you know, I know that's happened to me a few times where I've gotten my coffee paid for me by pretty, and I'm like, you know what, I'm going to buy the next two coffee then after that. And who knows where it went from there. And so, but ultimately it's about action. There's a lot of talk out there. You know, we talked before earlier, I think, about, you know, me wanting to try and do things differently. Like, that's what's worked for me. It's fine looking what everybody else is doing and then finding another way around it. Well, most people just want to talk. So the more people that do, it will exponentiate really quick, in my opinion.
No, I 100% agree with you that take action and live what you say. And that's the most important thing. Is like you're saying, without action, it's dead. And you're just perceived as a hypocrite. And whatever you're trying to accomplish has no value to anybody else.
Yeah. And people are always looking for excuses to not do something, right? So if you're that person, all you're doing is perpetuating the cycle of laziness and not doing the right thing.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. So it kind of leads us into your story of what happened through your military career and mental health. Can you unpack that for us and tell us about that?
Yeah. So at the end of the last one, we talked about in April 2007, right after I just lost my medic and one of my best friends and was wounded pretty severely myself, we had a suicide bomber that hit us and killed 9 of my guys under my command. And I was like, I was at my breaking point. And I attempted to go to the unit doc, and he's obviously not to be named. And he said, you know, Jesse, if you go attempt to talk to somebody, because I asked, and he said, if you talk to somebody, they're going to diagnose you with PTSD and you're going to lose your security clearance. You're going to lose your command and you'll never lead Rangers again. And instead he gave me, you know, a bottle of Xanax. And after that point, I pretty much had an unlimited supply of it. And, you know, I wasn't using it to get high or check out. I was using it just to suppress, you know, that delta level of where I was going to go over the edge. But the problem with that drug, you know, like alcohol, is it takes more and more and more to get the same effect. And I was on a ridiculously high amount of it while I was on active duty, while I was in combat. And when I got back, and it worked. I mean, it was a temporary solution. And you know, that doctor's job was to keep me in the fight. And it worked for a long period of time, 5 years after that. And so when I got back from that deployment, I really wasn't a big drinker. And it wasn't because I was against it, or I didn't like to lose control. And so when I got back, you know, at the time I didn't understand the effects of alcohol on your brain and benzos, which Xanax is the benzodiazepine, but they basically were the same way. So when I got back, when I had that first drink, I mean, it was like, man, I just found the key to life. You know, take the drug that's prescribed to me by a doctor during the day and drink at night. And, you know, for me, my deployment cycles were so much that I never got like physically addicted to it. But man, I was an alcoholic the second, by the book medical definition, the second I took that first drink. And so, you know, I was able to maintain that all the way up to the point that I retired. And then when I retired, you know, I lied up and down with the doctors that tried to help me, because the retirement was focused on my knee from the 4 reconstructive surgeries I had. But, you know, they wanted to try and diagnose me with PTSD, and I fought it, and I was able to convince several people that I was okay. But then when I retired, you know, I was able to very easily go to another psychiatrist that looked at my record and was like, holy crap, man. And, you know, kept it. I kept the prescriptions up, and then I was obviously able to continue drinking. And for me, it was at the point when the number of suicides matched, you know, number of suicides from guys that I'd served with matched the number that I lost in that company, which was 14 overall, that I finally decided, you know, I realized if I don't do something about this, I'm going to become one of these statistics. And, you know, up until that point, I'd done everything I could to help everybody else in the world be the best version of themselves. And I finally realized, you know, maybe the best thing I can do for these guys, that many of them, we didn't want to have anything to do with each other because being around each other reminded us of the situations. So it wasn't like I had ready access, but I was like, you know what, maybe if I just set the example, you know, some will follow. And so that was the inspiration for going to get help with it. And I went thinking kind of like, okay, you know, alcohol is a problem. And I very quickly realized that that was a symptom of the problem. And so I thought the problem was, you know, the PTSD, which I did have. And it was undiagnosed and untreated for a long time. I went through 32 different medications with the VA to try and deal with what was going on. And the problem is that I wasn't doing any therapy. And so, you know, just to cap that off, like as soon as I started taking therapy seriously, I immediately was able to cut everything out. And so for anybody that is listening to this and you're like, man, nothing will work from the doctor, it's because those are stopgaps in order for you to get to the real stuff. So when I realized that the alcohol was simply a symptom, not simply, but a symptom of the problem, I thought it was, you know, the PTSD. And so I came to this realization, like, well, this is like a pressure cooker analogy. Like what's inside the pressure cooker is the PTSD. The outside of it, the lid is the alcohol, which is keeping the PTSD in. And, you know, what happens when you rip the lid off a pressure cooker, right? You have to release the valve. And the way that the VA at the time was wanting to deal with it was, we're just going to deal with alcohol. That's your problem. And I think that's the main problem with a lot of people in addiction, is they attempt to treat the alcohol or the drug or the behavior when that's not the problem. It's the solution, yeah. Temporarily. And so for me, I very quickly realized that I needed to be able to release the valve, because I was worried that once I left that first VA that I attempted to go to, it was just like ripping the lid right off, and that's what happened. And so once I realized that was the case and said, okay, I need to attack this differently, I started, you know, working more dually on the PTSD and the alcohol, and things got a little bit better, but it still wasn't getting manageable. It was still a struggle to stay away from suppressing those emotions that were boiling up. And so that's when I started really digging into what is the problem. What is the root, the true problem.
Yeah. So as you're talking about that, treating the symptom, it's like if you've got a giant thorny weed growing in your lawn or your garden, and you just keep pulling the top of it off. You're like, that'll do it. That's good. You're never going to, that weed's going to continue to come back until you get every single bit of that root out.
Yeah, exactly. And so for me, I finally had to come to the realization that, I'm a data guy, right? I mean, I was an engineer in college. Math was the only thing that really made sense to me, even though I allegedly was in smart kid classes for English and history. I would take data points, right? And I'd be like, what is causing me to drink? Well, it wasn't necessarily the PTSD. It was this like surge of emotions and what I now call capacity to be an a-hole was boiling up. And the only thing that could bring it back down was the alcohol. But the problem is the alcohol would only work temporarily. And then they would both rise up to the point that just the pot exploded again. And so as soon as I identified and realized that was the problem and started working on it, man, my desire for alcohol immediately went away. And I can honestly say that I cannot recall a time that I've been on an urge to drink since I've been on that journey to attack the problem, which for me was, this capacity to be an a-hole. And, when I was in the Army, I was not promoted. I was not chosen for the jobs. I did not go to the school I went to because I was such an upstanding human being. I was chosen because I had a capacity to do something. And at the time, it was very useful to our nation. I could go and I could do a job that oftentimes required me to kill and move on the next day. And so all of a sudden, when I got out of the Army and that capacity was no longer needed, it was still there. And so for me, when I realized that was a problem and I started attacking it, which the only way you can really attack that problem is to do good, it's like that's what started, creating the balance in my life. And so when I work with, people, in the recovery community or the trauma community that have some sort of behavioral addiction, I always encourage them to ask that question themselves. What is the problem? And oftentimes the problem is not always, PTSD or some other, I don't call it mental condition, but essentially that. And the ones that I've worked with have had better success than the average person walking into those communities.
That as I reflect on do my own self work and my own self development, I look at situations and maybe my kids are throwing a temper tantrum or something, and I just lose it. There's actually a funny story the other day. We were at Walmart, and I just was having a rough day. Just done. I was tired. I want to go home, put the kids to bed and just veg out and go to sleep. And we were going down the aisle and my kids are running around. They're screaming, having fun. And they weren't being bad, but they're just being loud. And I kept getting after them. And my wife said, "They're kids. Why are you yelling at them? They're just being kids." And I stopped for a second and I thought, and I said it out loud. I said, "I just want them to act like adults right now. I don't want to be a parent." And I realized how stupid that was of a thing for me to say, and that I was actually really missing out on an opportunity to have a good memory of my kids instead of having his memory being mad at them. So the symptom wasn't my kids were being loud. It was that I had an expectation of them to be quiet, which is unrealistic. And so I think that's why we have so many, why we get so upset is we set expectations that are unrealistic. Or if we do have reasonable expectations and they're not met, we don't let the person or someone know what that expectation is. And that's where anger and frustration comes from.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, man, I've had the incredible opportunity to go and work with some of the Wounded Warrior battalions across the Army now. And when I was getting out, that opportunity wasn't there. And they get to do a much better transition, still not perfect, but a much better transition than I got to do. But understand, I went from being Major Jesse Stewart to civilian overnight. No transition, no counseling for it, no decompression or any of that stuff. I literally left Fort Leavenworth on Command and General Staff College on a Friday and signed into my new company on a Monday and did not take my 2 months of terminal leave that I had, and I just started. And the problem was I had the expectation that all those people in that company or anyway, just like the guys that I worked with. Unrealistic expectation. Well, what, when they didn't meet that expectation, what happened? I got angry. My capacity to be an a-hole blew through the roof. And so, you know, that's tying back to our other point of how we can help people. That's another thing, man. Expectation management, like to expect other people to have the same standards that we have is just absolutely unrealistic.
Yeah.
And something I had to just finally table, you know, a couple of years ago, because like even, so like athletes, I'm actually working on a little ebook right now that kind of talks about my morning routine and the Phoenix Rising. And I talk about, you know, like some of these athletes, these snowboarders don't want to get up at 5 a.m. to go work out with me. Now, does that mean that they're leaving, like they're less of athletes or less of people? No, they get up a little bit later. Not saying all of them do, but you know, some of them, and they start their day a little bit later. And so with the morning routine, I always say like, don't harp on, I know Jocko, you know, posts, you know, what time he wakes up every morning.
4:30. Yeah. It's obnoxious. Yeah,
4:30. You know, he actually answered that, why he does that on a Rogan's podcast recently. He said, you know why I get up at 4:30 in the morning? Because there's single mothers out there getting up at 3:30 in the morning to work their first of three shifts of the day.
Okay. I take back my last statement. That's admirable.
Yeah. And I thought that was awesome that he said that. So my expectations are like, I temper them and I attempt to meet them. Okay. If 10 a.m. is your start of your day, well, then we'll do sadhana and we'll do a little meditation or mindfulness exercise at 10 a.m. Like me. And now all of a sudden they're like, okay, yeah, I'll try it. And so, but if I was to sit there and say, no, you're gonna meet me at 5 a.m. They're gonna be like, screw you, dude. First of all, you're old. And no, I'm not getting up at 5 a.m. to do that. Yeah. And you all of a sudden just created a wall there.
Yeah.
And for the record, the athletes that I work with, they've all gotten up early with me. Now, whether they actually get up that early or not, I don't know, but hats off to them. But, you know, it's amazing when you manage those expectations, that's sometimes the best thing that you can do, you know, for somebody. But that also comes back to meeting somebody, you know, where they are, rather than expecting everyone else in the world to meet us where we are. Because I found very quickly that if I'm going to sit here and wait for everybody to meet me where I am, I'm going to be here a long time by myself.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's just kind of the mantra that I've tried to live with. And, you know, sometimes, you know, I'm arguably maybe a little more intense than the average person. I know that's hard to believe. So, you know, if I go into a situation and try and expect somebody to manage my intensity or match my intensity, how do you think that's going to work out? I'm going to be a huge turnoff. And so that's, you know, what it comes down to is that's probably the answer, better answer to your question earlier of how we can help you, you know, manage expectations. Don't put our expectations on other people.
No, because we all come from different places. We all come from different walks of life. So maybe someone who grew up with an ideal childhood, whatever you want to say that is, or someone who came from a broken childhood, if the person, either one of them are expecting them to be where they're at, you're going to have a lot of conflict.
Yeah. When I was in LA this past week doing filming for that, that platform, I met somebody that was, you know, telling me like, yeah, I mean, I feel bad, like even trying to talk that I was depressed or anxious or had suicidal thoughts or anything, because I had this amazing childhood, amazing parents, amazing opportunities for college and all this stuff. And I said, whoa, hang on a second there. So let's look at our childhoods. I said, if you didn't make straight A's, what were you look like in your house? He's like, I was a failure. I said, okay. If you didn't make the varsity team as a sophomore, what were you looked at? A failure. I said, okay. So you had to live your entire childhood with this expectation. If you weren't perfect, you were a failure. Say, okay, my childhood, like when I grew up, I didn't have any expectations. So anything I did was a bonus. Who's got, you know, more stress at that point? Arguably, you know, that other person. And so I was just telling him, you know, like, don't minimize your trauma and don't make excuses that your trauma is not on level with my trauma, because that's not what it's about. Trauma is trauma.
Yeah, and can't quantify it.
And it's different. Mm-hmm. Right. And what becomes magical is when we can come together with those differences and talk about how we've dealt with them. And so this person, you know, was able to realize that it was okay that they had these things. And there's a lot of people I've met in addiction that I'll sit there and say, like, I was the worst of alcoholics because I had no excuse. Well, if you had that pressure that your family, your entire lifeline was going to be taken away from you if you didn't achieve, wow, man, that is a recipe for disaster right there. So, you know, that's an important, you know, important point to make with, you know, people of, you know, when they go into like, why am I drinking? Well, it's because probably this expectation. So what was the problem? So then you need to go attack that problem right there, which most likely is still, if I didn't make X millions of dollars this year, then my family's not going to approve of me, or my wife's not going to approve of your husband, or whatever. And so, you know, it comes back to identifying that problem.
Yeah. What is your root? Where's the root? How do you get that out? And everyone's root, the weed is different. And we just can't expect somebody else to understand where we're coming from or where they're coming from. I think that that's key to being a successful human being. I want to go back a little bit about, you're talking about your capacity to be an a-hole. And I don't mean to me say this is like to make fun of you or you know, I think it's funny you put it that way or to belittle you, but what happened in you, what changed in you besides finding out your root cause of why you're acting that way, but what were some of the things that you did that are tangible or concepts you can teach to people to overcome that?
Yeah. So one thing that I realized very quickly, and whether this is true or not, and this is just something I had to tell myself in order to move on with life, I don't know, but I know it worked. So, you know, PTSD or any mental, you know, illness for that matter is essentially an energy, right? It's this energy that's inside you. And energy is not either good nor bad. It's what we do with that energy. Mm-hmm. It's either good, bad, constructive, destructive, or whatever. And so when I like realized this, I was like, okay, I've seen tangible evidence of the capacity of destruction that I have. So if I have that, well, then I've got to have an equal capacity to do good. And so once I realized that and I started putting that into action, that's when I started seeing the differences, like tangible differences, you know, in my existence, in my life, in my path. And that was the biggest realization that I came across. And I'm only speaking for myself. I'm not belittling anybody's, you know, conditions of what they have. I'm just speaking, you know, for myself. But if you sit there and look at it, the things that you do that are destructive in your life, what if you took the same level of effort to be constructive? I bet you can match it. Almost yeah. Guarantee it. And so that for me, that's where I was able to see, okay, yeah, I am able to match it. And I can attack this capacity with a new capacity, which is essentially a capacity for good.
I like that answer. I found that the greatest way to overcome hardship is to get outside yourself and serve someone.
Oh yeah. No, I beat that to the bone. That was what I was asked earlier about that. Like, how do you, when you're stuck inside your own head, what do you do? I'm like, well, do the opposite of what you're doing. Get out of your head. Right. I mean, it's pretty hard to not feel good about yourself when you turn around and do something for someone else. And I mean, that's science. They've done brain fMRIs yeah. on people, you know, they're alcoholics and non-alcoholics, where they gave the non-alcoholics a drink and they saw the fMRI studies light up or happy zones and all that stuff. And they had the alcoholics write about something good they'd done for somebody. Same exact areas lit up on the fMRI. So, I mean, it's science. And so, yeah. And people ask me, what do you do when you're down? When I'm down, I do something for someone else. I'm of service. And, you know, 12-step groups work for a reason. And the reason is the 12-step states, and I'll speak for the one that I know best, Alcoholics Anonymous, states, as a result of having had a spiritual awakening or having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the previous 11 steps. So as a result of having worked on you, me, first, I will strive to carry this message forward to alcoholics everywhere. And so I'll be of service to people. So the only way that you can keep your sobriety essentially is by giving it away. But you can't do that first until you fixed yourself. And so the science behind, you know, doing something good for someone, I mean, that obviously is proven, it's there, it's tangible. And so, yeah, when you're feeling down and out, go on Instagram and find someone has less followers than you or only has one or two likes on a post and go in there and like it. And then go back into their file and find a post that you can, with integrity, say something nice about. And then go make a nice comment on them. No expectation.
Bam. You know, you actually challenged me to do that earlier this week. You said just every morning find two people's posts that don't have any likes, or maybe one or two, and there's no comments, and go in there and say something genuine about it. And I've made that my goal. One of the first things I do in the morning when I go get out my phone, because that's part of my routine, get on social media, see what's going on in the world. It doesn't matter. But I did that. And the very first person I commented on, I didn't know. I think I was following them. They weren't following me. They didn't have a big following. And I said, I like that this because of this, 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 and this. And I typed a paragraph up. And I sent it to him. I was like, cool, I hope that made their day. 5 minutes later, they responded back. They said, thank you so much for taking the time to write that. This has made my day. And from then on, it's like, from now on, like, I want to make someone's day every day. Maybe it's not through social media. Maybe it's someone at the gas station. Maybe it's someone at the grocery store. But if I can get outside of myself and look for something good in somebody else and compliment them on it or add something positive to them or show them something they didn't know about themselves, I find myself in less often in low slumps.
Yeah. I mean, it's for me, man, it was about figuring out a way that I could take the energy that I had when I was in my 20s and when I was commanding, you know, troopers and Rangers and great Americans in Iraq. If I could take that same like energy output and put it towards, you know, something a little more positive, what can happen? And man, it's amazing. It is absolutely amazing. And it breeds more action after that.
It does. And I think if I were to sum that up in one word, that word would be love. Showing love for other people. And I think we've all heard the saying that love is the most powerful force in the universe. And I'm beginning to really understand that you can really accomplish anything with love as your motive, because there's no, it's altruistic and there's no self-serving purpose behind it. You're doing it genuinely because you want someone to feel better about themselves and feel loved. And you can't do that until you learn to love yourself.
Yeah. And that's the thing right there, man, is that people forget about and that I forgot about. So I'm just as guilty as anybody about this. You know, I wanted to help everybody else in the world be the best version of themselves, except for myself. And it wasn't until I realized, well, maybe the best thing I can do for my daughters is be the best version of a dad for them. Maybe the best thing I can do for a future, you know, spouse or life partner is be the best version of myself for them. And that's where things, you know, you talk about, you know, what kind of got you going around the change, that was a big issue of it, was turning inward. And that's what the Phoenix Project has all been about. There was never any grandiose plans for it to become what it has. And it all started with myself.
Yeah, it's incredible that you had that, actually, how do I say this? It's incredible that you had that awareness of what you were capable of doing. And then your willingness to share that with everyone else and open up and be vulnerable has impacted a lot of people. Personally, it's impacted me as well, and it's challenged me to be better. And the book's not even out, and the movie's not even out. Just hearing your story about that, it's like, I want to be more like that. And I kind of felt like I was on the right track already, but I feel like you sharing your story has given me more tools I didn't know existed to be a greater version of myself.
Well, I'll tell you what, man, what bred all of this was this idea, like, I did not do very well with being put in a box, right? I didn't do very well with being told what to do, which is horrible because that's probably what I needed. But like, so I wasn't, the VA way was not going to work for me. The AA way was not going to work for me. The CrossFit way was not going to work for me. And this, the church way, which I still feel bad about to this day, wasn't going to work for me. And so, but once I realized, like, okay, what if I can take parts of the VA, TRICARE, great civilian therapist, and make it part of my mental way? What if I can take 12-step groups, social media, which I hated up until a year ago, and make that part of my emotional, you know, and then take the, you know, physical fitness, and then take my faith and go there. And then all of a sudden it becomes my program. And so, like, I would never tell someone, like, hey, copy my program. I'll say, hey, here's a method that worked for me, and here's a good starting blocks of these four things. You plug and play, you know, what works for you along those methods. And if somebody wants to ask me how I did it, yeah. Because I mean, I didn't come up with all this stuff myself. I would listen, and I would watch, I would research, and I would pick what worked for me and plug and play until I found something that started jiving. And then it's always changing. You know, it's always evolving. It's always, I mean, the word optimizing has been like just drug through the mud, but that's what it is. It's optimizing all those things. And then all of a sudden you realize, you know, oh man, maybe these different planes complement each other. And that was where I was able to relate with the athletes was, hey, what if you can take the physical and take the mental and learn how to control the mental a little bit better and maybe even shut your mind down to get more times out of your workouts? Well, all of a sudden now you're bringing two planes up simultaneously with each other. And then what if you're working out with your teammates who normally you're competing against? Now you're all of a sudden you're pushing each other. So now three planes are simultaneously going, you know, up. And for me, man, it's, I appreciate the words because that's just, that's validity that I'm doing the right thing. And this isn't about, you know, just being a show, a freak show, which I don't know, arguably at times maybe it is, but at least it's entertaining.
It's a valuable freak show.
That helps with the emotional plane. Makes you smile. But it's that's what it's about. So I'm glad you find encouragement. But man, I find encouragement from you, you know, as well. And everybody that I meet, you know, being in LA this last week, I got to meet some really cool people that, you know, they were, you know, claiming to be in awe of my story. I'm like, man, you started a company from nothing and turned it into this and then sold it and then started something that was even better that's now providing a service that makes people's lives more manageable. That's incredible. I want to hear more about that. And so then all of a sudden it's just, it's no longer a one-upmanship, you know, who's better or anything. It's about how can we make each other, you know, better and come collaborate. That's why the mission statement of AM300 is, you know, develop, collaborate, and deliver hard-fought wisdom for winning in life. Notice it's not Jesse develops it and Jesse delivers it. It's we collaborate, develop, and deliver it. And that's what this is about.
So it's a process that's been formed, and everyone's process is going to be different. So I remember when I was going through the depths of my addiction and I felt completely hopeless. Like I don't even know how to describe how hopeless I felt. And angry all the time because I couldn't overcome it. And I'd every time I went to a meeting and I'd see people who had sobriety, I thought to myself, if I could just get to the point where they're at, get to that destination, I'd be so much happier. But what I've come to realize is life has no finish line. There is no destination. The destination that we see is a perception of success. And if we are only striving to get to a certain point, when we get there, we're not going to be satisfied. Instead, we need to have a process that's continually evolving to make us better.
So now you're teasing out more answers to your previous question of like, what did you do to get to that turning point? That's another thing that was huge for me. Up until 3 years ago, and I think we briefly touched on this at the end of the last one, you know, I was all about awards, plaques, recognition, promotions, destinations, all that stuff. And I remember I was listening to a guy speak that I had a lot of respect for, and he was talking about, someone asked him like, what's your favorite race finish or something like that? He's an ultra endurance athlete. And he said, none of them. You know, I honestly can't even tell you about him because I don't remember them. But what I do remember is the training runs, the bike crashes, the almost drowning, you know, just all this stuff. And he said, it's about the journey. It's about the process. And there's a great book that I don't know if I have assigned it to you for reading yet. I'm just kidding. The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday. And it's a great book that just really slams that fact that, you know, we spend so much effort and time trying to evolve, go around, hack, you know, obstacles that we forget, like, wait, maybe those obstacles are life. They are the way. And that was something that definitely was huge with my point. And it doesn't mean you can't be proud of checkpoints along the journey, right? So my opportunity to command those amazing 149 guys over that 3-year period, that was a checkpoint. And I want to remember that checkpoint in life. And that's why I still have, you know, those plaques up that remember that time. You know, my Army career was a checkpoint. And so I don't, for a long time, I kept all my stuff in one room in my house and never brought it up. And once I was able to acknowledge, like, okay, these are checkpoints in life, it becomes a lot different. And you're able to appreciate it. And you're able to say, you know what? Yeah, I went through a crappy situation, that deployment, that plaque over there is from it. There's 49 people listed with Purple Hearts from that unit. But that helped shape me. Mm-hmm. And that puts things in a lot different perspective.
Yeah, my wife told me when I was really struggling, she said, you can do this. She tells me, this is kind of her motto with me when I'm struggling. She'll say, you can do hard things because you've done hard things in the past. And so when we look at, you know, these awards, these certificates, achievements, whatever it is that we accomplishments, we can look at it and say, I can do hard things because I did that. You know, having your college degree up on the wall, like maybe some people see that as cheesy or whatever, but you can look at that and say, yeah, I don't identify by my college degree, but I identify by what I accomplished. And every time I see that, that reminds me that I can do hard things.
Exactly. It's what is it, you know, is it an idol to you, or right, is it remembrance? And that's, I think, the big difference in there. And you know what? For a while, I did idolize that stuff because that was my existence. And you know, maybe that's why subconsciously I kept it in that one room. And but yeah, those are all super key things that I think are valid for anybody.
Yeah. So now that you're at this point where you've refined a process that's working for you, do you know who you are as a soul and what your purpose in life is?
Always evolving, man. I have a better idea than I had yesterday. And all the things that I did today were an attempt to have a better idea than today. It's a process. And I don't have it figured out. I never will have it figured out. But I'm going to die trying. And so it's, you know, I learned a long time ago that I'm not going to have it figured out. And that's okay, because I can always, you know, I can all, like every day that I go to bed, I ask myself, was I better today than I was yesterday? And what conditions did I set that tomorrow I can be a better version of myself that day? You know, the shirts I wear when I work out, they say you versus you. And I wear those because, man, I used to be all about crushing everybody. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, you know what? What if I turn this competition inward? Because if I'm trying to crush this guy in the CrossFit gym or something, you know, and he's a top guy, what happens when I beat him? Who else is there to beat? No one. But when I put that top guy as myself, and I'm able to make the goals be that, then there's no, like, you're never going to get out of shape, you know, in that way. You're never going to stop learning or getting, you know, smarter about your trade or your craft or your work or whatever that you're doing. Yeah. So, no, I mean, I would say I have a better idea than I did a month ago, 6 months ago, a year ago, 3 years ago, but I will never sit back and say, you know what? I have got this figured out, because I think that's when Murphy just comes to bite you. Yeah. Is when you think that you've gotten to that point.
So So I don't know if you answered this question right, if I missed it or not, but do you know what your purpose in life is?
Yeah. So we kind of teased into that, I think on the last time. And, you know, my overall purpose in life is to serve humanity and leave this place a little bit better than I came in. That is my goal. And that is what I believe my purpose is. There's a great book called The Alchemist, and it talks about finding your personal legend. And I read the book like six times before I read it in June of 2017 again. But that idea of, you know, finding your true personal legend, and those that go off to far lands and they forget that oftentimes that personal legend is in our own backyard. Hmm. Yeah. So for me, it comes down to serving humanity and trying to leave this place a little bit better than I found it. Well, I've been on the opposite end of that, of the destruction and various levels, from war, from being back home after war and stuff like that. And so I wouldn't say that I have a blood debt, you know, to make up, but I kind of feel that I do. And that's okay, because that's what keeps me going and to try and make up for those things, you know, from the past. But I also see the impact that it has on someone when I take the time to do that. And that keeps me going in that matter. So that's a loaded question. And I wish I would have prepared a little bit more for it, but that's probably the best way that I can summarize it.
No, I think it's a good answer. And it kind of answers my next question I had for you, which is, how would you define living a good life? And I think you just answered it.
So that one I can give you a little bit more refined answer.
Okay. Yeah.
So have you ever heard of the difference between success and excellence?
Yes, you've told me, but why don't you tell the audience?
Yeah. So success is based on awards, accomplishments, podiums, medals, etc. Excellence is focused on doing the little things to such a high standard that they become automatic. And then all of a sudden, when you do that, success just becomes a natural byproduct of living a life of excellence.
I like that a lot. So if someone was struggling with addiction or struggling with depression now, and where would you tell them to start? With what little things would you tell them to start making excellent?
Well, easy thing is routine. You know, get yourself in a routine, get yourself on a schedule and hold to it. You know, give yourself tasks in the morning. You know, sit down at night and I prefer to put it on paper. But you know, put your little list of things that you're going to do first thing in the morning before you go off to work. You know, I'm going to sit there, I'm going to read for 5 minutes. I'm going to go work out for 30 minutes. I'm going to, you know, do whatever. You know, I'm going to clean my room. I'm going to make my bed. I'm going to make my bed so that way I have got at least one victory right off the bat. No matter what, if I fail everything else in the day, at least I have that one win, that bed is made. And when I come home, I've at least got to clean better. I mean, just set little goals, because all of a sudden those little goals, they translate into bigger goals or bigger accomplishments. And you know, I'd not come up with that myself. That was something Bob Castlin taught me. And he'd had the opportunity to bring Coach K in from Duke. Right before he deployed as a 25th Infantry Division commander, he had him come in and do an officer professional development with his division staff. And that was Coach K's theme. As he said, listen, or maybe someone asked him, you know, how is it Duke had so much success? He goes, we've had no success. We just live in a culture of excellence. Huh. That's as simple as it is. I mean, you look at Duke, more NBA players graduate from college than any other school probably in the nation.
Yeah, they put out four or five guys every single year.
Yeah, it's because they do all the little things to a level of excellence. And so for someone that's just kind of trying to get things straight, and man, when I feel things spiraling a little bit, I'll go back to that all the time. I'll go back to my little journal, and I'll sit there right now. Here are the dang things I need to get accomplished in the morning. And then all of a sudden that stuff becomes automatic. And then you can move on to the bigger things. You know, it's like the people ask, you know, how do you get a year of recovery? One day at a time.
It's like 1 second at a time sometimes.
Sometimes, yes.
One moment at a time.
Yeah. How do I not want to kill this person that I work with? 1 second at a time. Right? It's that easy.
Yeah, I relate to that too much. Yeah. Been there. But,
it's like everybody's about these big, complex life hacks. Keep it simple. Like, keep it simple. And if you can do the simple things well, then you'll be able to do the big things excellent, right? It's like those things will just become automatic to you. And so that's probably the biggest thing that I can recommend, not only to someone, but to anyone that's struggling, anyone that's overwhelmed. I mean, being overwhelmed, that leads to anxiety, right? Mm-hmm. How can you reduce being overwhelmed? Break it down. It was like we were talking the other day about like all these different projects that you have going on. You know, like break it down into a manageable project for each little thing that you have and have measurable goals and milestones within those projects.
Yeah. So I did an interview with Captain Stephanie Worth a few episodes ago, and she talked about setting goals, and that's almost verbatim what she said, that to achieve goals, write them down, have measurable, obtainable actions, so that you can look back on and say, oh, I am making progress, not some big, big destination far away that you can't see it until you get there. But if you have those little steps, you can look back on and say, oh, I'm doing better. It's like you said that you ask yourself, am I better than I were yesterday? That's how you accomplish goals.
Yeah. And so you have something to be able to measure, you know, back off of as well. Yeah. So it's not rocket science. Dumb Army Ranger is able to figure it out.
Oh, it's funny. So kind of want to change subjects a little bit, kind of go into a little bit of stoicism. But I want to ask you, how can we find peace within ourselves, since it may appear that the world is burning down around us?
Yeah, so my whole like introduction to stoicism came from, all my mentors, like looking back, they were stoics. I mean, you know, General Stanley McChrystal, they write about him being a stoic now. General Castlin, definitely a stoic. And so I got to a certain point where I realized that I reached kind of a glass ceiling with the mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual. Felt like I was like at a glass ceiling. And what I realized was the mental, emotional, and physical, and spiritual were like apps in a computer, right? Well, in order for apps to work, you have to have an operating system that kind of manages it. And for me, that operating system is a life philosophy, guiding life philosophy. And I was like, oh, that's probably what I'm missing. I don't have a firm, grounded life philosophy. Okay, well, what is my philosophy? And as I started kind of researching, I realized that the Stoic philosophy fit my personality and what I'd already been, doing and the people that I admired. And Stoicism then, so Stoicism is all about creating space in your decision-making process, right? It's not about being emotionless. It's not about, being a Stoic where I've got no personality. It's about creating space in your decision-making process. So with the mental, what if you could create some space in your mental reactions to when people piss you off? Like, what if you create 10 to 15 seconds before you respond to that person that just you want to unload on? What's likely going to happen? You're going to come down and your reaction's going to be a lot different. With the emotional, with your spouse or your kids or something, if they do something that pisses you off, what do you want to do? You want to unload. But what if you were to wait that 15 seconds before you respond? Your response is most likely going to be different. And the physical, if we just work out, you're never going to get stronger. You have to have that space and rest period. And on the spiritual, I see it as like meditation. And meditation was articulated this way to me once before, and I've held on to it, is meditating is us listening to God. Prayer is us talking to God. Well, if I think most people that have a prayer life, probably 99% of it's prayer and maybe 1% meditation. But if I think that what I have to say is more important than what my higher power has to say, I can tell you that's not the case. And so it's about creating that space. And so for Stoicism, for me, that's what it's about. This is about creating space in my decision-making processes in life. Meditation is listening to God. Prayer is talking to God. And if we think what we have to say is more important than God, then hey, good luck with that. Or higher power, whatever you want to describe it as.
Let's talk a little bit about gratitude. So why is it important to not only have gratitude, but to express gratitude? And how does that affect our minds and our mentality and our mental health?
All right, so I'll give you one example of that. So I have a journal. Every night before I go to bed, I make two lists. One list is, the first one I do is my resentment list. And so what I'll do is I'll write down all the things that I'm basically pissed off about or resentful about, or I'm scared of. So it's a fear resentment list. And so I'll write those down. So for instance, it might be, you know, my daughters aren't going to like me or love me or whatever. My ex is whatever. It just all these things that are absolutely out of my control. So I'll write all those down. You know, people aren't going to want to ever buy it. Like I'm going to sell one copy of the Phoenix Project and Richard Bell is going to buy it. That's it. And you know, bargain shelf. So I write all this down. So let's say there's 9 things on that resentment list. Next to that, I'll draw a line. And next to that, I will write down all the things that I am grateful for. And I will not stop until that's at least plus one from the number of fears or resentments that I list. So before I go to bed, I have tangible data right there in front of me that I have a whole hell of a lot more to be grateful for than I do to be fearful or resentful for. And man, that's impactful for me, at least going to bed. And I took that one step further. I read a book called Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself by Dr. Joe Dispenza, I think is how you spell his last name. But he wrote this book where he talks about the power of being grateful for things before they even happen. And he had done this huge funded research study showing that like people that would wake up in the morning and do essentially a preemptive gratitude list would have like more good things happen throughout their day. And so I will, you know, in the morning as I'm going through kind of my to-do list, I'll be like, I'm grateful for the conversation that I'm going to have with this person that could potentially be difficult. I'm grateful for, you know, the workout that I'm going to have, that I'm going to become stronger. I'm grateful for the conversation I'm going to have with my daughter. I'm grateful for all those things. So if you go into it with an attitude of gratitude, which that sounds kind of corny and canned, but you know, it's amazing, you know, what that can, the effect that that can have on you. And I mean, when you're next time you're pissed off, just try it. Like write down all the things you're pissed off about. And then next to it, write down all the things that you have to be grateful for. And then measure how pissed off you still are.
And actually, there was a study done by, I believe it was Harvard, and the Army has implemented this into their resiliency training. They call it Hunt the Good Stuff, where every day you write down 3 good things that happen. And within 3 weeks' time, your brain starts to form new synapses where you're focusing on good, positive things rather than threats and negative things that we do to survive. So you're literally changing your brain, you're reprogramming it from a surviving to thriving standpoint. And I started doing that for a while and I found that it really worked. And I've fallen out of the habit and I'm gonna need to get back into it. And after this conversation, I'm actually going to be. But here's an example of this. I've seen it happen in my kids. There was one Sunday morning, my daughter Lila, who you just met, and she was throwing a temper tantrum and she's so upset. Like I couldn't get her to calm down. She's like, I'm not going to church. I hate you. Blah, blah, blah. And I was like, you're going to church. You're going to love Jesus. And I was like, you know, it was just one of those conversations. And I was like, what am I going to do? And I thought for a second and I went and I grabbed her a little notebook. One of these notebooks, the Army notebooks, right? I got a billion of them lying around. And a brand new pen for her. And when we got to church, I sat down and I said, before you say one more word, I want you to write down three good things in your life. And a couple minutes later, she handed me a list and she said, Dad, I love you. I'm sorry I was mean. I'm sorry I said those things. So if that works in a child, it'll work in an adult too. So that attitude of gratitude, when we manifest the things that we want to happen in our life and we're grateful for the things that we have, it changes the way our brain functions, is what I've learned.
So based off my experience, whatever you set your intention for at the beginning of any event, ideally the day, that's what's going to carry you forward. So every morning when I wake up, I do a sadhana. All right. It's my morning routine. It consists of first thing I drink is this mountain spring water with a little bit of organic lemon and pink Himalayan sea salt. I found that is like the perfect mixture to bring my body to homeostasis after I have slept. And I drink that. And then I sit down and I do my sadhana, which is a 15-minute meditation exercise where I do 10 minutes of seated upper body movements designed at opening up my spine from the base up to the neck. And then I do a 5-minute 4-count breath meditation. Then when I finish that, and well, I've started that, I set my intention for the day. That intention is always stillness and focus. And then whatever I have going on for that day will be focused around what I want to be in that. But I always start my day with an intention of stillness and focus, because if I don't, Preston, my day is going to be hijacked by the intention of the rest of the world, which is chaos, craziness, and just absolute disaster. But if I set the intention myself, so if I set an intention to be grateful for something, yes, that's going to carry on. And if you continue that, it's going to be consistent. And it's like doing the little things excellent. The bigger things, success just becomes natural. And I think that's right along the same, you know, guidepost.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I'm curious though, at what point did you decide on those two intentions? And did you have previous ones you tried that didn't work?
Biggest problem doing.
You just look at it like, this is where I need to improve. Okay. I mean, this is what
I still struggle with being still.
What does stillness mean to you?
Well, stillness, my version of stillness and the average person's version of stillness is probably two different things, for one.
That's why I ask, yeah.
I'm more still than I would. Like if you were to speak to Kara, okay, she will tell you when she knows I'm not doing my routine. It's so blatantly obvious because my barometer is way past. Because by nature, that's just who I am. But that's an energy, right? So if I can harness that energy and I can focus that energy, I'm going to actually get stuff done. I'm going to have impact. Because if I come into a conversation with you and I don't have stillness and focus, we are going to talk about the entire world and we're going to solve every problem.
Right.
That solves nothing. Yeah. And so like that's what that does. And so I guess for me, it was like I recognize my two biggest limitations, inability to be still and lack of focus. And so I put intention on it. And man, think about it. If you go into a meeting, all right, and everybody else is flying off the handle, they're dealing with 10 different things, but you come in and you have stillness and focus, you can drive that meeting. If you don't, you're just going to jump on the crazy train with them. Yeah. And so, you know, when you go into a stressful meeting or something like that at work, or try it. Just, you know, do a short, you know, it doesn't have to be a sadhana or a meditation. Just sit there and be like, I'm going to be still because everybody else is not. And I'm going to be focused because likely everyone is not going to be that either. And it's amazing what happens when you go in with that intention and how much more you retain. And when I've got an incredible opportunity to work with some venture capitalists in San Francisco, and that's all I work with them on. And it's under the auspice of what if you, like in a typical meeting, like you have an hour long meeting and then you probably spend the next 3 hours re-clarifying everything that we said in the meeting. Well, what if you actually were there in a state of focus and stillness that you actually took stuff in, and instead of waiting for everyone to shut up so you can say what you have to say, you're actually receiving. Like, you're not going to have to go back. So for them, it's about efficiency. And my stillness and focus journey is not about being Zen. It's not about being this, you know, glorified yogi. Man, don't get me wrong. It's about efficiency. And it's about getting things done, because that's what brings me, you know, some contentness in my life. So it's about efficiency. And for me, it works.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I really like that. It reminds me of the quote by Stephen Covey. He says, most people listen with the intent to reply. Instead, listen with the intent to understand. And if you're listening just to respond, you're not going to be connecting with that other person. It goes right back to what we were talking about at the very beginning. You're not going to be meeting someone where they're at if you're listening with the intent to reply. But if you're listening to understand them, then you'll know where they're at and where to begin.
It's not easy.
It's not. It takes practice. But all these things we're talking about, they're habits. They're talking about forming habits to create a better version of ourselves. The best possible version of ourselves. It's done through our habits.
It's been hijacked. And it's become like a click and a cool thing to put as a hashtag or something like that. But, you know, for me, it works. Mm-hmm. And it's worked to the point that I've got a, you know, a great relationship with my daughters now. You know, I've got a great relationship with my fiance. And life is, I've got nothing to complain about. Well, that's not true. I could come up with 9 things mm-hmm. Wanted to, but my intention and my intention is not on those 9 things, right? It's on that one thing that is right.
Yeah, I think that's a great goal to begin your process. Just find that goal to focus on. Well, we're going for about 1.5 hours now, so I have 2 questions for you before we go. And the first question is, what is your opinion on Bigfoot?
I knew you were going to ask that. If you need to believe in something and that's what you need to believe in, then more power to you.
No, I just like to do that for fun. But this is actually a very serious question. If in the next 30 seconds, whatever you said would be heard and understood by every single person in the world, what would you say?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry for, you know, the amount of stress, you know, that I've caused people, caused my daughters, caused my ex, caused my parents, caused my family, because my entire life has been about, you know, proving myself and having to win. And like, that was my first addiction, was winning and doing. And so, you know, through my actions that hopefully you've seen, you know, that's what I'm trying to do. And so, I actually just connected with an Iraqi on Facebook that I did not, an interpreter that I did not treat very well. And I had an opportunity to make ask for forgiveness. You know, so I would say that I'm sorry. And I hope that what the world's seeing is I'm trying to make up for those things and make the world a little bit better than either I caused it or I found it.
No, I think that's something we should all be striving to do. And thank you for sharing that with us. I appreciate your time and appreciate your willingness to open up and share with me, especially and the audience. The relationship that I've formed with you over the past few weeks is unique compared to any relationship I've ever had. And it's a pleasure to get to work with you and have you as a friend. And thank you so much.
Well, ditto. I look forward to seeing where your podcast goes. I know it's gonna go great, and I am super excited about it.
Hey guys, be sure to follow the Metal Mentality Podcast on social media. And as always, if you find value in the show, please leave a review and rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. But more importantly, share this podcast with someone you know who would benefit from the messages from the guests on each episode. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter @MetalMentality.